Good communications is an important means of bringing the peoples of the world closer to each other. And I am confident that those who operate the SEACOM cable will contribute their part towards this end.
The opening of the SEACOM network today demonstrates that modern technology, by contracting time and distance, has brought us so much closer together that we are all virtually next door neighbors to each other.
Asia on the line. That was the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tunku Abdul Rahman, and the Acting Prime Minister of Singapore, Dr. Toh Chin Chi, talking this afternoon with Australia, Great Britain, Canada and New Zealand on the new Southeast Asia Commonwealth cable system, SEACOM, officially opened today by Her Majesty the Queen. Host of the opening was Australia's Acting Prime Minister, the Right Honourable John McEwen.
I have full confidence that this thin metal band will provide a bridge of understanding between us all. I first will call on Malaysia. Will you please come in, Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tunku Abdul Rahman?
It is a great credit to all those who have contributed in one way or another to such a successful completion of the project.
Thank you, Tunku. I will now ask you, Dr. Toh Chin Chi, Acting Prime Minister of Singapore, will you come in and speak to us, Doctor?
The clarity with which this telephone conversation is coming through makes the gathering in this room feel that Mr. McEwen must be speaking next door and not in Sydney. I do not know whether our Australian colleague will agree that this establishes Singapore's claim to be the gateway to Australia.
Now I will ask the Right Honourable Keith Holyoake, Prime Minister of New Zealand. Keith, would you come in and speak to us, please?
Thank you, John. I'd like to give a special word of greeting to our friends in Malaysia and Singapore and also in Hong Kong, with whom we are joined for the very first time by this great SEACOM cable. We're all brought very much closer together by this fine engineering feat.
I'm now going to ask the Honourable Robert Winters, Acting Prime Minister of Canada, to speak to us.
Now we envy you there, John, because while you bask in the sunshine of one of those lovely Australian autumn afternoons, we on this side of the earth are plunged in the darkness of a very early but beautiful spring morning. The clock on the Peace Tower of our Parliament building struck midnight, just as your Navy band sounded the fanfare. But I'm sure you'd be pleased and perhaps a little surprised at how bright this representative and enthusiastic group assembled here looks even at this hour.
You may have cold weather over there, but Canadians have warm hearts, we know. I will now ask the Right Honourable Herbert Bowden, Secretary of State for Commonwealth Affairs in the British government, to speak to us. Will you speak to us, Herbert, please?
We in London are now separated from our Commonwealth friends on the other side of the globe by less than a quarter of a second. I'm very proud that Britain has played a leading part in the development, manufacture, and laying of the cable itself.
We now have just a few minutes for a free-for-all discussion. I wonder, Tunku Abdul Rahman, would you have a word with Keith Holyoake and let whoever wants to buy in?
Hello. Hello.
Hello, Tunku.
How are you?
I'm Bonnie, thanks. Haven't seen you since London, PM's conference.
I do.
I see Charles Bennett sitting out right in front of me, and I'm sure the first question he'd like me to ask is, how's your golf?
He hasn't improved. I hope nobody asks
us how our hockey is.
He doesn't seem even to have changed.
Dr. Tao,
very loud.
What about you coming in, Doctor, and having a word with Bob Winters?
Right. Thank you very much indeed. Well, I'm very happy indeed, Mr. Winters, that CECOM is being opened at a very important date in Canada's history.
Well, it's very...
Sorry?
Well, I was going to say it's very exciting for me, Doctor, to have an opportunity of talking to you way over there in Singapore.
I don't think we have seen each other, but certainly I believe that the Pacific now is not too far, and Canadians should make an effort, really, to travel across the Pacific Basin and visit us.
Well, we'll fix all that up when you visit Expo this year.
Let's hear from Herbert, Herbert Bowden, please. You're going to fix up this Kennedy Round for us, Herbert.
Pardon?
You're going to fix up this Kennedy Round problem for us.
Well, I wonder.
The answer is yes.
We'll certainly do our very best, anyhow.
Right. Okay. I'm now going to call on His Excellency, the Governor of Hong Kong, Sir David Trench. Would you speak to us?
May I say, too, that it will be a boon also to the many families here who have sons and daughters in Australia and in Canada and in England and in New Zealand being educated and from whom they are now separated, but who will now be able to speak to each other quickly and easily whenever they wish.
This will be wonderful. It will put us all very much closer together, Sir David. And I think we've had a very interesting chat now, and my clock tells me that time has caught up with us.
CECOM goes by microwave from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore, and then by cable on the ocean bed to North Borneo, up to Hong Kong, down again to the American island of Guam, on south to Madang, around the foot of New Guinea to Cairns, and there, leaving the ocean, send his messages on to Sydney by microwave to join the Commonwealth Pacific Cable Compact, which goes to London. CECOM's 7,000 miles carries telephone calls and telegrams, telex messages, computer information, photos, and radio programs. How does it work? How did it come about? The story from the General Manager of Australia's Overseas Telecommunications Commission, Mr. Harold White.
The round-the-world Commonwealth cable concept, which was born in the late 1950s, resulted in the first instance in a transatlantic cable, which was a Canadian-British partnership. The Trans-Pacific Cable, COMPAC, brought about an enlargement in the partnership to include Australia and New Zealand. When the Asian section, CECOM, was launched, the partnership was enlarged still further by the inclusion of Malaysia and Singapore. I know of no other circumstance under which a major international project of this magnitude has been handled by a partnership of this nature, in which the funds, the management, the organization, the technical design, the operation of the project has been performed by what could only be regarded as a business partnership between nations. The costs are divided between the partners, and Australia's share is 28%. And certainly the largest percentage is held by Britain. I'm not quite sure of the actual figure. Mr. Peter Muehlmann is one of our most senior engineers and was assigned the task of controller on behalf of the six partner nations to supervise on behalf of the partnership the construction of the CECOM project.
Mr. Muehlmann can explain in greater detail.
The cable has to be able to withstand the huge strains that are involved in laying it in great ocean depths. And on CECOM, we have depths up to 5,000 fathoms. The strength of the cable is derived from a steel wire rope, about a quarter of an inch diameter, which is in the center. And over that, the conductor, which carries the communications, is a thin copper tube tightly wound around the steel wire rope. On top of that, about half an inch of polythene is extruded, and then there are aluminium tapes to provide an outer conductor, and as final protection, a polythene jacket about an eighth of an inch in thickness is moulded on. The total diameter of the ocean cable is a bit over an inch, about an inch and an eighth. Where the cable comes onto shore and encounters surf or rock or coral, we put on armour. allowing for the fact that the cable can break, it's necessary for us to keep ships ready to put to sea at short notice to pick up the cable and make any repairs that are necessary. The cable lands in Australia at Cairns, on a beach about 5 miles out from the city, and the cable is buried between the beach landing and the terminal station at Cairns.
Our man responsible for the installation at Cairns was Alan Hennessy.
Cairns itself is actually on an inlet. It is protected from the ocean proper by the Great Barrier Reef, and it doesn't ever really get really rough, other than, of course, if the sort of the wind crops up or something like that. The big difficulty is in actually the shallowness of the water. This then sort of limits how close the cable ship can come to the beach. There actually was a car ferry hired from Townsville to complete the cable itself. The reef has a number of openings. The ships use these to entrance into the ports. A suitable opening is then chosen for to lay the cable through. The section between Madang and Cairns, it was laid in two operations, from Madang around to the northeastern tip of New Guinea. The ship was then required to return to then pick up enough cable to complete the lay into Cairns.
Man has been communicating for thousands of years in crude ways, becoming less crude as time has gone on. It's only the last 100 years or so that transoceanic telegraph cables capable of carrying Morse code and simple messages of that nature have been available. It's only in the last 10 to 15 years that wideband coaxial cables capable of being laid at depth in oceans have become available and have brought about this great spate of cable construction around the world, of which the Commonwealth has a substantial part. This is a technical development of considerable magnitude by any standards. Mr. Peter Muehlmann can best give you some more of the technical details.
The Seacom cable takes 80 channels in some parts and 160 channels in other parts between the terminals concerned. It's difficult to explain how these actually work, but the best analogy I can think of is to think of the sending end of the cable as a number of small radio transmitters, each tuned to a separate frequency. And at the receiving end, you can imagine that we have a number of receivers, each tuned to the same frequency as the corresponding transmitter at the other end. And this means that you can send a separate channel for each transmitter-receiver combination. As the message comes along the cable, it is considerably diminished, and we find that every 20 to 30 miles, a repeater has to be placed. This is a valve amplifier, which is connected into the cable, and the power for the repeaters is also fed along the cable from the terminal stations at each end. As you know, all electronic components are subject to failure from time to time, but these are built under most stringent conditions. In fact, the whole of the internal components of the repeater are gold-plated as a protection against corrosion, and many of the components are aged before they're ever installed in the repeater. The repeater is made under operating theatre conditions almost, and is filled with dry gas and hermetically sealed when it's completed. In addition, each repeater in fact contains two amplifiers, which are arranged to work together so that if one of them were to cease to function, the other one could carry on with very little degradation in the overall performance of the cable. To look at one, you would think it was just like a torpedo. It is perhaps 10 feet long and 10 inches or so in diameter. It would weigh of the order of half a ton. The cable is mainly made of polythene, and it sinks comparatively slowly. But the repeater would sink quickly. But to overcome this, just as it touches the water, a parachute is opened, and that reduces its rate of sinking to exactly the same as that of the cable.
There is tremendous progress in the development of cables themselves, which are certainly far from passé as a medium. When Compaq was laid, the most advanced deep-sea cable available was capable of carrying 80 voice circuits. Today, it's uneconomical to purchase and lay a cable which has less than 480 voice circuits. And work is proceeding at the present time with transistorized amplified cables capable of carrying up to 1,500 voice circuits. This puts the cable in the position of a modern medium capable of carrying at a very economical rate tremendous volumes of telecommunications traffic up to and including the greatest bandwidth requirements demanded by television and such media with a facility and economy which is at least equal to that available in satellite communications and in some respects with a technical capability which is superior. Of course, this doesn't deny the tremendous impact which satellites have made on communications. Satellite communications, of course, have the tremendous advantage of flexibility. One can communicate with countries over half the globe without the task of laying deep-sea cables. On the other hand, all of the communications must go through a particular satellite, and the satellite itself has similar limitation and, in a sense, vulnerability as have a cable. We endeavoured to launch a satellite last October from Cape Kennedy, and it failed. This is not to say that the satellite is not a highly efficient medium for communications. I'm trying to establish a balance because the breathtaking sweep of the advent of satellites has tended to push aside the capabilities of cables. They are not identical media. Each has their strengths and weaknesses. Both will go on for a considerable time to come. Mr. Muehlmann can perhaps pick up the story.
About 3 years ago, we finished a cable across the Pacific, Compaq, between Sydney and Vancouver in Canada. And this in turn links across Canada to existing cables across the Atlantic. Some of the Seacom channels connect through on these to Montreal and London.
We've been rather staggered by the growth of traffic. Before 1963, we had 13 speech circuits with the rest of the world, by radio, of course. When Compaq was opened with 80 voice circuits out of Sydney, it was expected that this capacity would be sufficient to last until 1980. As it transpired, we placed the last circuit into service this year, in 1967. And were it not for the fact that we had more capacity coming along in the form of developments on the cable, one of which is a device called TASI, Time Assignment Speech Interpolation, and were it not for the fact that we were proceeding rapidly with satellite communications, we would be facing a serious situation because of an underestimation of traffic. Again, this is an area that Mr. Muehlmann might best comment on.
TASI is a switching device, and it makes use of the fact that every telephone conversation uses a two-way channel. One for me to talk to you, and the other direction for you to talk to me. But normally, you would be listening to me and not talking, and thus the channel which allows for your voice to come to me is idle. Now, this sophisticated switching device, which we call TASI, switches this channel, the idle channel, from you to me, to enable someone else to make use of it.
Telegraph traffic, overseas cables, telegrams, are growing at the rate of 8 or 9% a year at the present time. Telephone speech traffic is growing at the rate of about 25% a year. International telex traffic is growing at the rate of more than 30% a year. The growth in the leasing of exclusive lease circuits is of the order of hundreds of percent, but it's a relatively new service, and of course, it's natural that there would be a pent-up demand which is being met in the early years. Nevertheless, these growth rates are very substantial and, of course, far in excess of the growth rate in population and national productivity.
Most of the technical equipment for Compaq and Seacom is installed in our building at Paddington. And this equipment includes an automatic exchange which enables overseas operators to dial numbers in Australia and to get onward connection to Seacom from Compaq and vice versa. The officer in charge of the Paddington terminal is Orm Cooper.
And we have the international telex, that is the system where a local subscriber, say in Sydney, wishes to send a message to, say, the Commonwealth Bank in London, and by calling into the system here, they are connected through to the subscriber in London, and the message is sent directly from one office to the other. If the officers concerned have sufficient quantity of traffic, they sometimes will hire a permanent channel, and there are quite a lot of these, such as the airline companies and banks do it. Japanese wolf buying firms do it. In the telex, it has a big advantage, of course, that one doesn't have to get your subscriber out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning to send a message to him. So the teleprinter can be automatically switched on by certain signals being sent and automatically switched off at the conclusion of the message, and an automatic acknowledgement is also sent. So when the office staff arrive in, say, London in the morning at 9 o'clock, here on the teleprinter may be messages received from all various parts of the world, yet nobody was in attendance during the evening or the night time to receive them.
All of these improvements and increases in capacity have been brought about with no change in the cost of calls to the consumer. If there is a change in rates, it will be downward rather than upward. Singapore is a place which is at the other end of the CECOM system. To Singapore, a greeting letter telegram can be sent for what we regard as a low rate, and certainly is one of the lowest rates in the world. A minimum of 11 words can be sent for 85 cents. For telephone, a minimum of 3 minutes costs $7.50 to Singapore, with $2.50 for each additional minute. Of course, with the introduction of the cable, the quality will be enormously improved. For speech, the speech will be like a local telephone call, whereas formerly, telephone communications with a place like Singapore were by HF radio, and if you recall listening to shortwave radio, perhaps cricket broadcast, you'll have an idea of the difference in quality between that and a local telephone call. The cable now makes it possible for us to provide virtually an on-demand service, which means that if somebody wishes to telephone a business associate in Singapore or Hong Kong, they can make the telephone call and almost certainly get through instantly, that is, without having to put the receiver down. I say the almost certainly because if they happen to pick Christmas Eve or some other such peak time, then they might have to wait for a few minutes.
The CECOM story came from the general manager of the OTC, Mr. Harold White. And now, Her Majesty the Queen, as she declared the cable open from London this afternoon.
I'm very happy to have this opportunity of talking to you on the Southeast Asia Commonwealth Cable. It is another step towards a completely reliable worldwide system of communications. It will contribute to a better understanding between nations and to lasting peace. The spirit of cooperation has always distinguished our own Commonwealth family of nations, and never more so than in the partnership which has evolved to build the Commonwealth Coaxial Submarine Cable Network. We can take a quiet pride in the fact this whole project was conceived and designed, manufactured and installed within the Commonwealth. The cable now stretches 23,000 miles around the world. It has been constructed in 6 years. To have achieved so much and so quickly is the highest possible testimonial to those responsible. As I speak to you, my words are carried instantly across the Atlantic Ocean, the mainland of Canada, the Pacific Ocean and Tasman Sea, the Australian states of New South Wales and Queensland, and the Coral and China Seas. To know this is to marvel at the technical accomplishments which have made it possible. I hope this enterprise will infuse new vigour into the developing economy of Southeast Asia, strengthen political and cultural ties, and open up new trade routes to the rest of the world. I congratulate the partner countries, Australia, Britain, Canada, Federation of Malaysia, New Zealand and Singapore, and I now declare open the Southeast Asia Commonwealth Cable.
And with the official opening, we end Asia on the Line. Your narrator was Martin Royal, producer Dennis Harrison.